I start with a little late. Okay, I know that Josh went down, that was starting the Six-Day War. This is sort of a little bit right before the Six-Day War. I still wanted to talk about two more Mossad things that will be important for the Six-Day War. Okay, we spoke about Isser Harel. He was the head of Mossad. He was in charge of Eichmann. The person who took over for Isser Harel is a guy named Meir Amit. And Meir Amit went around to all of the different defense units of the IDF and said, what can we do for you, right? What would make your life easier? She goes to, who spent a lot of time speaking about in the upcoming days, the head of the Israeli Air Force, Mordechai or Mati Yehud. Okay, he's like the hero of the Six-Day War with what the Air Force did in the beginning. We'll get to that. And he says to him, he takes over 1963, and he says to him, get me a MiG-21. Weird request, but give me a MiG-21. What's a MiG-21? It was the newest Russian airplane. Okay? Any army needs to know the weapons of the enemy. You need to know, you know, how it works. You need to know what it's good at, what it's not so good at. In the little army service that I did, we studied all sorts of guns. Okay? We have this gun, how this worked, and I was in there with like 54 Russians, so all of a sudden you get to the Kalashnikov, they all start laughing. Oh, the Kalashnikov! They all know what the Kalashnikov was. That's what the Russians used. So you need to know what it's good at, what it's not good at. Right? So here, if you're going to be having dogfights in the air, your Air Force against theirs, you need to know how does the MiG-21 operate. Now, they had lucked out in 1956. During that Sinai campaign, there was an Egyptian who abandoned his plane intact and ran away. And they captured that plane. So that was good for a while, but the Arabs already got upgraded to the new MiG-21s. So now he said, if you can get me a MiG-21, that would be fantastic. That would be my dream.
Just the one?
What?
Just the one?
We just need one to understand how it works. Right? Once you know how, let's say for example, you know it has a blind spot. So then you know how to come from the blind spot in a dogfight.
No, we have Google.
I don't know if Google tells you all. It's not the same thing, right? You need to know. Now,
what did he ask?
Mati Hod, Meir Amit, new head of the Mossad, goes to Mati Hod.
What year is
this? Air Force, 1963. He says, what can I do to make your life easier? So if you get me a big 21, that would make my life easier. Okay. Now, Egypt had placed, you know, a premium. Anyone who was flying a MiG-21, you weren't just a good pilot, you were the cream of the cream. This is the top pilots, and therefore their trustworthiness was impeccable. To try to get some guy to bribe them is going to be very difficult. So Israel was having a very difficult time trying to get their hands on any information, let alone the plane itself. Aside from getting the plane for Israel, it would serve great purpose in the United States-Israel relationship. Because right now, America and Russia, they're in the middle of the Cold War. And therefore, America would like to know as much as they could about a MiG-21 in case they ever need to know in any of their potential battles. So if Israel could supply the United States with information about a MiG-21, that would go a long way vis-a-vis their relationships and having America do things for Israel. This went on for decades, still goes on today. Israel and the intelligence service finds out things and helps America. There were rumors that I read recently, but I might have gone back, that Israel already gave a tip off before 9/11 that something big was being planned. You know, you have spies that are hearing different things and you're passing on information. Yeah.
Does Israel have any benefit besides for telling America about these things?
100% for Israel, because they're going to be fighting against Egypt in whatever's going to be the next war. Oh. No one thinks that there's going to be no wars. We had one in 48, we had one in 56. No one made peace
with us. We had one in 56?
We had 56, final campaign. And no one thinks that we're going to have peace. So yes, we're always in preparation for the next war.
These Russian planes
are now being supplied
by
Russia to Egypt. These are Russian-made planes. As far as they knew, as far as the world knew, This was the best fighter plane now made in the world. Okay? So Israel needed to know, and America would like to know as well. Okay. '64. Israel starts hearing. They've got people on the ground. That's how the Mossad works. They have all sorts of people working. And they find out there is one pilot who's dissatisfied. He's Christian. Most people here were... Okay. Where was this, my dad? Okay. In Iraq. In Iraqi Air Force, most of the pilots are Muslim, and yet there's one guy who's Christian. His name is Munir Redfa. Okay, I remember it was the weirdest thing. I took my kids, I knew the story, I took my kids to the Israeli Air Force Museum. Anyone ever been there? None of you guys went on like a trip or whatever? So you have this Israeli Air Force Museum, there's something inside, mostly stuff outside, all these different planes, they show you the first planes that they had, all different things like that. Inside, you see a mannequin dressed in like Arabic flight suit without helmet, and it says nothing about him. And it's just like standing there. And I knew exactly this whole story, so I explained it to my kids. But clearly it's something about where the guy takes you around, so he explains to you. But there wasn't even a plaque or something explaining who this was. But here's the story. You're over there and you see this no plaque, no explanation, Arab pilot standing in the middle of the, you know, the museum. This is his story. So Munir Redfa is a Christian Iraqi pilot, disenchanted with the orders that he's getting. He's being told by the Iraqi government they should bomb the Kurdish villages. He's not feeling very good about what he's doing. They're sort of helpless, and he's not happy. Even some people overheard him expressing his admiration for a little Israel, standing up to the Arab countries. Okay, at this point, Israel sends this American woman, Mossad agent, once again, not clear if she's Jewish, not Jewish, whatever it is. It's an American woman who is now this charming, attractive socialite who is mixing with all the elite in social circles and going to the parties. And being a very well-respected pilot, he also is there. She starts up conversations with him. And before you know it, they have a relationship going, right? Have a relationship going. As I said, he even expresses a little bit of his admiration for Israel. He tells her how the Russians are running everything here in Iraq. These Russians are overseeing everything. They don't even let the pilots fill up their tanks. They give them a little bit of fuel and send them on some training mission. And they come back and he feels like we're not even respected here. Okay. And she listens, and slowly their intimacy grows, even though he has his wife and kids, several kids, but their relationship grows. Okay. 1966, she exploits the relationship and says that they should have a little holiday together in Europe. And he agrees. And while there, she just comes out and says, look, I work for Israel, this is what we need. And she brings other people there and says, here's what we can do. We can get you and your family out of the country, but we need you to steal a MiG-21. And obviously, a little bittersweet. He realizes that she never had any feelings for him. Okay. Once you get over your ego, he then starts thinking the whole thing through.
That's good.
Israel's willing to pay him $1 million. It's $1 million in 1966. Right? I know you figure out what it would be now, but I'm assuming a heck of a lot more than $1 million. Right? And he says, you know what? I'm not happy here. I know it's a risk. I'm getting good money. I'm down. And he agrees. He agrees. And they say, listen, this is going to be dangerous. You have to fly 900 kilometers. Your colleagues, they're going to figure out what you're doing. They're going to try to blow you out of the air. He goes, what you're going to have to do is follow what we tell you. We know the route we're going to send you on. They don't know it. and you just have to trust us. And he says, okay. And then slowly, the Masson starts arranging for a family member here, ends up getting out of the country, and another one, and slowly getting the family members out. But Minuretra says, I will bring you the plane. August 16th, 1966, business as usual. He goes over to the ground crew and says, you know what, today, fill the tanks. And the Iraqis all felt like, yeah, screw the Russians. Yeah. Even though the Russians always said, yeah, we'll fill the tanks. Fill the tanks for him. Unsuspecting that he was about to leave the country. And, you know, happy to obey the star pilot against the Russian directives. And he takes off, at first heading out towards Baghdad, and all of a sudden veers off to Jerusalem. The ground crew radar picks up this blip, and they start saying, you know, radio, turn around, turn around, he doesn't listen. They warn him, we're going to shoot you down. He turns off the radio, and he flies. He follows Israeli planes, meet him, and they guide him in. They escort him to Israel. And as I said, the pilot's family ostensibly went for a picnic, and then were driven over the Iraqi border to the Kurdish area, which was anti-the Iraqi government, and from there they got him out, got him to Iran, which at this time, again, Israel had good relations with Iran, and got them to Israel. All the newspapers throughout the world had the story about this pilot of a MiG that defected and went to Israel. Like all other news stories, you know, it made the headlines for the first day or two, and then slowly went to back pages and forgotten. Except it certainly wasn't forgotten by all of the Western powers, who now were very excited to see what, you know, this MiG was all about, in case they ever had to meet up with this MiG. You know, Israel is now entertaining the head of the Air Force from America and England. Everyone's coming to see and bringing their experts to check out the plane. Now, if you're wondering, how did it help? Right before the war begins, April 7, 1967, a dogfight ensues with Syria between IAF planes, which were just like the French Mirages, not fantastic, great planes, and against the Russian MiGs. And in the dogfight, Israel shot down six MiGs and lost zero.
Was that again what happened?
In a fight between Israel and Syria, right before the Six-Day War broke out, Israel took out six MiGs to zero losses. So if you'd say, did it have, you know, any help, it definitely did. Wow. They were able to study, like I said, figured out from which area to come, where was the blind spot, what the cape was capable of, what it was not capable of. And this was, you know, the defection of Minuretra, and Israel.
Wait, how did this girl, right, she came to Israel, she's like, I can help you guys?
No, she was a Mossad agent. She was sent to Iraq.
Right. And at the same time, like, what was I going to say? Right. So what was the whole thing? How did you get to know this guy? This girl went to Iraq and she, like...
Yeah, she's hanging out at the parties. They find out which parties he hangs out. And she comes home to him at a party. I mean, like, you should know, this is what happens. This is the real world. And that's how... You know. Okay. Now. Yeah.
Okay.
The most famous spy in Israel, and I've said this already before, and I'll say it again, he's only most famous because he got caught. For all we know, there are people that have done even crazier things than Eli Cohn. He's never got caught. So we don't even know. But Eli Cohn's story is amazing. You know, there have been books written. And as we know now, there's a Netflix movie that just came out, a five-part movie, called The Spy. There are anachronisms in that movie. I remember watching it, I know about Israel history. That happened at the beginning of the movie. He's walking with his wife, and they're watching on the television all this stuff that's going on and in Syria. And, like, you know, feeling they need to go and do something. There was no television in Israel at that time. The television in Israel didn't come to the 70s, just in the 60s. Whatever. Okay, fine. But whatever. It was all part of the film. Fine. Now, before the Six-Day War, Yitzhak Shamir, who would go on to be a prime minister in Israel, who we spoke about earlier, who was the leader of the Lehi, the Stern Gang, after Yair Stern was killed by the British. And he went on to a long career in Mossad before he became in the Knesset. And he writes that very often it's darkest right before the dawn. And 67 is like this beautiful time period, the Six-Day War, and we all talk about the glory. But beforehand, it was like so gloomy in Israel that there were all these jokes. You know, people were leaving the country, and like the joke was, last Israeli at the airport, please hit the lights on the way out. People were like leaving. And then, he said, in the middle of all this gloom, there was this fantastic story about some spy who was working in Damascus with all of these things that he did. And people were like, freak, what? How crazy. So here's the story. Here's a picture. Eli Cohen, on the top, is when they hanged him. On the bottom, this is what he looked like. He looks Arabic. And he was. I mean, like, and we'll talk about his story, but he was generally loved by the people in Damascus.
Oh, you know what? Yeah. I was watching a video about him. There is like a video of him, like, of them taking him off, being hanged, like putting him in a grave
online. Yeah. Okay, here's another picture of him hanged. They wrote down on this sheet all of these things that he did. It's like people should see that. It's crazy because, like, to his kavod, people say, oh, he stole this, he did this, that's crazy. But they all the stuff there. They let him, they hang him there, I think, for days.
Did Israel try to get
still
him
back?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No. But here's the story. Okay? Eli Cohen was known as a man of Damascus. He was hanged in Damascus Square, hands tied behind his back. At midnight, Cohen was taken from the prison to the police station. He looked stunned. He calmed down a little bit. He writes a letter to his wife, Nadia, darling. You're entitled to marry another man in order to provide for our children with a better future. I ask you not to mourn, but it's happened to look to the future. Okay, he walks to the gallows. He's pronounced dead for 90 seconds, spot on. Left there for the 6 hours. For 4 years, he was sending coded messages to Israel on a small radio transmitter. And, let's see. During the trial, Israel offered to exchange for him Syrian prisoners of war. Damascus rejected the offer. Offers came in from all over the world. Israel offered $1 million. Okay, it was all turned down. Till today, Syria refuses to let his body be buried in Israel.
I heard that Mossad did some operations so they try to get his body back.
Could be. As far as we know.
Did they want anything, or they just wanted him to, just suffer?
Suffer for what he did. It was such an embarrassment.
So there was nothing that we could have given to get him back?
Right. The Pope called. Emma's calling.
Wow.
Nothing. Speaking in an interview with Syrian television reporter 24 hours before his execution, Eli Cohen said, quote, I went to Syria on a mission from the Israeli intelligence to secure a future for my wife, my children, and my family. I was willing to undertake such a risky mission. I did not betray Israel. Okay. But what's the story? From 49 to 67, Israel was being bombarded from the Golan Heights. The Golan Heights was in the hands of Syria, and life in the north of Israel was unbearable. For 19 years, settlements in the north lived under constant threat of fire, and there were bunkers along the Golan Heights. And after 67, since then we have the Golan Heights, we've now had this safe border. But for the 19 years before that, it was the worst border. We captured the Golan Heights in 1967, and a lot of credit goes to one man, Eli Cohen, and that's what we're going to see right now. Eli Cohen was born in Egypt. Who here was born in Egypt? One of you guys? Forgot. Eli Cohen was born in Egypt, December 1928. His parents were Syrian Jews from Aleppo, and they were from, and they instilled in him, their educationally minded son, the traditions of Jewish people. He had a fantastic memory from his learning. The culture of the Jewish Syrian community in particular, his parents instilled that in him. Even though he grew up in Egypt, that's where he was born, his parents were Syrians and they brought him up to understand the culture. 1949, his parents and three brothers moved to Israel. Eli Cohen remained in Egypt to coordinate Jewish and Zionist activities there, right? To help get other Jews out, and he was stayed on. Okay. At the age of 29, he's already now living in Israel. He offered his services to the Israeli intelligence service. So look, I'm from an Arabic country. I speak Arabic, so I spoke to you about before. You have all these people that come from these countries. You don't have to fake, you know, he's from these countries. Let me work for you. And he was rejected twice by the Mossad. They didn't take him. He wasn't even drafted into the regular army. He was placed in like reserve Israel Air Force formation as a logistic clerk. Now, why was he rejected? Not clear, but possibly we found an intelligence evaluation that says the agency included that Cohen had a high IQ, great bravery, phenomenal memory, and the ability to keep a secret. Well, that sounds pretty good, right? That's why they reject him. But the test also showed that in spite of his modest appearance, he has an exaggerated sense of self-importance and a lot of internal tension. Interesting. So they're worried that he's a, you know, Balgaiva, and not, something's not straight inside. And they said that Cohen does not always evaluate danger correctly, is liable to assume risks beyond those which are necessary. Which is very interesting, because it's sort of what got him killed. Okay? So here's this thing. It's an interesting thing. You would say, oh, great, some guy with bravery, fearless, send him out. So no, you don't want to get him killed. Right? So we don't need someone that's going to be, there's a fine line between, you know, bravery and stupidity. So, scared that he's going to cross that line. Okay, fine. 1959, he marries an Iraqi Jew, Nadia Majald. He works as an accountant. And he's working, trying to bring up his kids. 1960, Israel is ready to take another look at Eli Cohen. Okay. After all, he was born in an Arab country, he looked Arabic, he was known to be fearless, and Eli Cohen already had a job, right? So how does the Mossad take another look at somebody? You get him fired from the job. You know? So, no biggie. So now Eli Cohen finds himself for some inexplicable reason unemployed. When the Mossad comes over to him and says, you're interested in, oh, okay, you know, I need a job, right? So he now comes in. His training was extensive. He was taught high-speed evasive driving techniques, weapon proficiency, especially with small arms, topography, map reading, sabotage, and most important, radio transmission and cryptography. What's cryptography? Right, all these different codes, right? So people can't understand what you're sending them to be able to read the codes. Now, these codes were instrumental for his survival as a guy named Kamal Amin Tabet. That was going to be Eli Cohen's cover. Kamal Amin Tabet was going to be his new identity. For us, we think that, you know, okay, Arabic is Arabic. But the same way we know that Americans speak different than Englishmen, an Egyptian accent is very different than a Syrian accent. So he spent a lot of time with Mossad, has all these people helping him, that he had to perfect his Syrian accent, because right now he spoke fluent Egyptian, he spoke fluent Arabic, but he spoke with an Egyptian accent. So he had to get down his Syrian accent. Okay, that was done. Now, what's going to be his cover? His cover is going to be, he was born in Beirut, moved to Syrian Muslim parents. His father was Amin Tabet, his mother was Saadia Ibrahim. And according to his fictional biography, the family moved to Argentina, they opened a successful textile business, everything's textiles here, okay? And Kamal Amin Tabet returns to Syria, ostensibly to fulfill a lifelong patriotic dream. Okay? Now, 1961, Chaim Herzog, who was the son of Chief Rabbi of Israel, we spoke about him before, Isaac HaLevi Herzog. Chaim Herzog would later go on to be the president of Israel. Now he's the head of military intelligence, and he signs Eli Cohen on this document authorizing him to be a spy. He's driven to the airport with his wife, Nadia, and she sees him off, and all she understands is that he's working for the Minister of Defense, but she didn't know where or what capacity. She was told to be completely safe, and she believed that until he was captured in 1965. Okay, it's like a friend of mine told me he's got cousins who are in this very secretive unit in the Army, and he said that the head of the unit told his cousins, like the parents, that if you ever want to know, you know, what your son is up to, just call me and I'll tell you he's okay. No, that's what I'm going to tell you no matter what. He's okay. So here as well, they weren't going to tell her anything about what, you know, he's doing. But she thinks, okay, I'm working for military defense. What does that mean? Lots of people. And he's like, the guy from my community worked for military defense. He would go and check out, like, what weapons to buy and stuff like that. Okay, maybe that's what he's doing. Okay. Eli Cohn was sent to Buenos Aires, Argentina, to establish his cover as a Syrian emigre. He soon established himself in the social and cultural life of the Syrian community of Buenos Aires. He was known as a wealthy businessman, generous, tipped well, loved the nightlife. He soon became accepted, well-liked, and respected, made contacts with politicians, diplomats, and many military officials working out of the Syrian embassy. One of them was Colonel Amin al-Hafaz, who was a supporter of the secular leftist Ba'ath Party. Now, at this point, a lot of his hashgacha pratis. He becomes friendly with a guy who is higher up in the opposition party. And when they make their way back to Syria, both of them, he'll be close with him when he actually comes to power. So he already made this connection. He made this connection when the guy was a nobody to the opposition. All right? But they cultivate this relationship, which turns out to be very, very good. He nurtures this through all sorts of lavish dinner parties, social occasions, which led to him getting invited to Damascus. Even better, instead of him moving into Damascus, he gets invited because people think this guy's got a lot of money. He can grease our businesses. Let's bring him over, and he'll help us. So Eli Cohn, all right, if you insist, you know, so it's fantastic. Instead of him coming to Syria and being suspicious what's going on in Syria, he was invited as guests of, you know, as business associates of already well-known people. And he makes his way to Syria. Now, 9 months later, Eli comes back to Israel for a visit with his wife Nadia, obviously through Europe and all sorts of things. He spent most of his time in Tel Aviv, though, perfecting his cover, briefing Aman as military intelligence, on the requirements of him in Syria, last-minute intelligence data. Now, Israel is amazed at how high up he's gotten and all the information that he's getting. This is great. He now comes to Syria in 1962. He's a businessman from Argentina returning to his native homeland. At this point, the Ba'ath Party was rising, and Eli Cohn wanted to be there when it took power. And as I said, he already cultivated all of these relationships, and he continues this as they get there. He has parties at his home. It turns into orgies for high-placed Syrian ministers, businessmen, and others who Eli used the apartment for. They all came in. See in the movie, gives key to people, does all sorts of things. He is making friends with all the right people. He brings in secretaries, airline hostesses, Syrian singing stars, belly dancers, you name it. They're all coming to his parties, people having a great time. And at this party, as in most parties, the more the alcohol flows, the more the secrets do as well. And Eli Cohn would feign being intoxicated, but really held his liquor quite well, and he would gather all the information that people were spilling. And he is then going through his radio transmitter and sending back information to Israel. Eli Cohn became like a husband hunter, right? He was like, everyone was looking for him. What did I write then? Oh, the husband hunters among the Damascus rich all were flocking to him. Here it is, this good-looking guy who is loaded. Sailing with an errand. Eli Cohn had no less than 17 girlfriends. Okay, which... Okay, which was important in case he ever needed help. These women would hopefully help him in a time of crisis. Okay? It's that old stuff we see in James Bond movies. These are real. These are things that happen. Again, cultivating assets. And this is what he's doing. Now, he became a confidant of George Saif, who was high up in the Ministry of Information. He had such complete trust that one day, you see this in the movie, Eliab Cohen is sitting in his office. Saif is on the phone. There's a document on the on his desk marked top secret. Eliab Cohen picks it up and he's leaping through it. And Saif is ignoring it. Right? And somebody walks in and starts screaming, "What are you doing? How are you letting?" And he goes, "No, no, don't worry about it. He's a trusted friend." Right? You think about it. Here's this guy working for Israel, just leaping through in front of the head of, you know, things, leaping through. It's all good. Don't worry about it. The Ba'ath Party takes over 1963, and Eli is firmly entrenched in Syrian high society. Okay, as I said, still sending stuff back, periodically gets together with his family, not so often. Yes?
In the Netflix documentary, he was like the one who made it happen.
Okay. Helping them get into power.
Is that?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't have that over here. I don't know. Okay? Now, one of the coolest things that he did, he gets to go on the Golan Heights. Right? This is the most secretive place. And he gets to go on the Golan Heights, and he takes pictures, just like we have Wolfgang Loss in front of the plane. Takes Wolf pictures him, you know, posing the Golan Heights. But he does something even cooler. He says to a high-ranking officer, "Look, the guys out here, they're baking in the hot sun. On me!" And Israel sends eucalyptus trees to be planted near every bunker in order to give them shade. When the Six-Day War broke out and Israel captured the Golan, they knew exactly where every bunker was. They aimed for the eucalyptus trees and blew up every single bunker on the Golan Heights. That's how we captured the Golan Heights, thanks to the eucalyptus trees paid for by Israel, you know, delivered by Eli Cohen.
This knowing that a couple years ago,
they didn't know when it would happen, but as I said, Israel knew there would be an eventual war. They were already shooting down the Golan Heights all the time, making Israel's life miserable. So he paid for it. They said, "Wow, what a great idea. Why don't we think of that?" Okay? Eucalyptus trees by every bunker. Now, yes, pretty crazy. Eli's friendship with Amin al-Hafez proved very valuable. Al-Hafez becomes prime minister of Syria. And guess who he wants to be defense minister? Eli Cohen's on the short list.
Amin al-Thabit.
Right, my bad. Right. Amin al-Thabit is on the short list of people that might be named the new defense minister of Syria. How crazy is that? Right? Now what happened? During this time, there were people that were, how is it that Israel keeps knowing all these things, going raids, there must be a leak, right? And they got newer Russian devices to try to find where radio transmissions were coming from, and they found them. They caught Eli Cohen, January 1965. They broke into his home in the middle of a transmission.
How did they catch him with transmission?
Because they got new devices that was able to pick up and pinpoint. They heard where is this transmission? Something's being transmitted from this area. And they found it. And they caught him. They suspected something was going on. And they caught him. They burst in the middle of a communication. The Syrians tried to get Eli Cohen to transmit some false information. It was already prearranged code. And he sent the code that meant that he was captured. There's nothing he can do. They tortured him. He wouldn't give any information. His captors even admitted how noble he was and how courageous, and they couldn't understand. He went through terrible, terrible torture. There was a TV movie that was made about him many years ago. Whether this is true or not, I don't know, but they couldn't understand. They kept looking at him and said, "But you're more like us than like them." Meaning what? You're Arabic. You grew up in Egypt. And them meant those Ashkenazi Israelis. Like, why are you working for them? Right? They couldn't understand it.
How did they know if he was working for Israelis?
He was caught in the middle of the transmission.
How did they know if he wasn't going to spy for someone else?
I guess the idea was, how did Israel keep knowing about all of the, you know, all the raids and things going on? Like in the TV show that was about him many years ago, I don't remember now what it was called, like the last scene is that he was able to report there was like going to be some over the border raid into this kibbutz, and the last scene you see these infiltrators coming into the kibbutz, and they go into a home in the kibbutz in order to like kill some family in their beds, and army soldiers pop out of the beds and blow them away because they have the information that they were coming. Whether that happened or not, I don't know. That wasn't in the last movie. That he gave information constantly that things were going on, that was for sure going on.
Well, was he defenseman for...
He never made defense minister. He was caught before that. He was on the short list. It was like a short list of people that were up for the job. He was caught before that. World leaders, wealthy individuals, Israeli government, the Pope, all intervened to no avail. He was hanged on May 18, 1965. It was broadcast on Syrian television.
You know what his family thought of it?
Well, it was his wife and small children. She's still alive. Nadia Cohen is still alive. And she was interviewed, as was, I think, the oldest of his children, about the newest Netflix movie. They thought that it would make him do, like, one thing, he scales a wall to get information. They felt that he wouldn't have risked his life to do stuff like that. But they don't necessarily know what he did. I don't know if the movie's depicting it accurately either, but they felt that they made him taking too many risks. We know from the fact that he did take too many risks. We know that he said that, you know, I think they might be onto me, but he continued doing this. And also, Israel pushed them. They were getting so much information. They pushed him a little bit. They didn't want to lose this information.
Do you think it was worth a little bit, like knowing how much they
It have? Might be. But the question is always, do you sacrifice
personal lives?
Yeah.
One for many?
Look.
Everybody's life is valuable, though.
Okay, but
I hear what you're saying. Anyone who's going into the army, any commander who sends out a group, knows that there's a good chance right over here, this group is a decoy, so that everyone come around. Okay, but that the decoy group could all get killed. Okay. You have that. You sacrifice the pawn sometimes when you're playing the game. I get that. I'm just saying, this is what happened. You know, till this day, his body is not returned. Till this day, every major city in Israel has got a street named after him. And it's clear that he succeeded far beyond capabilities of most of the men. And like I said, it was crazy. It was genuinely liked, even loved by the people in Syria. They thought he was like, they were boys. I mean, like that, they were really tight with him. And he fit into the lifestyle there. Never suspected of being a spy, you know, up until the end. And that's why, you know, he's known as Israel's greatest spy. As I said, a lot of our victories, certainly the last 2 days of the Six-Day War, capturing the Golan Heights, a lot of that has to be attributed to Eli Cohen. All right. Yes?
Was there ever a time, like, before he got caught that he tried or he wanted to get back to Israel?
Not clear, but at least in the movie they make it sound that way. All right?
What movie is this?
Netflix put out a movie last year called The Spy.
It's a show.
It's a movie. It's not a documentary.
So
Sacha Baron Cohen plays Eli Cohen.
It's a show.
I don't know, but it's
a show.
Long.
It's five episodes.
It's six episodes.
Yeah,
well, six episodes. It's very good. Very good. You'll get a lot of information. Very good.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt that like, in the picture, Eli Cohen looks so arrogant. Sacha Baron Cohen doesn't. You know, I don't know. Whatever. All right. Tomorrow, that's about the show. We start the 6 day.
Crossfire. Thank you.
My pleasure.